Lessons learned in a year of operating a flight school. I'm Paul Platt, and this is Aero News. Welcome into the Aero News special feature. Thanks for downloading us today. It's Monday. That means it's Miller time. Bob Miller is here from Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. You can find that on the web. Also, with Bob Miller Flight Training in the Buffalo, New York area, located at the Lancaster Buffalo Airport. And we're going to talk about a topic today that isn't necessarily strictly safety related, but Bob Miller Flight Training set out to do some somewhat novel things a little over a year ago when it was founded in the middle of December, just before a recession, by the way. And Bob's going to share some of those observations on how those things have gone with us today. Bob, thanks for joining us.
As always, Paul, it's my pleasure.
All right. Now, you start out, Bob, with three basic premises, things that you set out to do when you started Bob Miller Flight Training. Tell us what those three things are.
Well, we looked around at the industry, flight training industry, and asked ourselves if three things could be changed, what would they be? Or if three objectives could be accomplished, what would they be that would do the most for our industry? And we came up with the following three. Number one, produce safer, more proficient pilots. No argument there. That should be job one of any flight school. Number two, we have to recognize that 60% of all new students fail to make it to check ride. That's out of 6 out of every 10 students that walk into the typical flight school never make it to check ride. So our second goal was to reduce the student dropout rate. And thirdly, and this is often underplayed, or at least not spoken very loudly about, we have to demonstrate the profitability of flight training. If the flight school cannot make money, if the flight instructor cannot earn a decent living, the forces of the local economy will drive them out of business. So those were our three premises, or our three goals that we set out to achieve. And in 13 months of operation, I believe we've done all three.
All right. Now let's go down these one by one. Produce safer, more proficient pilots. If I'm playing devil's advocate here, I want to say every flight school wants to do that. Obviously, some are more successful at it than others, but how can a group of people who all have this as a goal have such widely varying results?
People, in order to learn, they have to want to learn. And in order to learn, learning has to be fun. The first thing we did is we altered the training curricula. Now, we can't change the contents of the training curricula because that's mandated by the FARs, but we can certainly change the order in which the curriculum is being delivered. We take our students from day one and we show them the exciting part of general aviation. Rather than putting cross-country trips on the end of the training curriculum, we put it at the beginning of the curriculum. Nobody wants to go to the gym. Nobody really wants to go out to the practice area and just practice slow flights, deep turns, stalls, and whatnot. They'll do that towards the end after we've we have to seduce them, if you will, into the romance of flying. And that goes a long way in terms of making flying more enjoyable, and it goes an equally long way in keeping them in the program. That's what we want to do. They want to get into the program. We want to make it exciting. We want to make it a way that they can kind of escape from the drudgery of the working world and see the romance of flying. And again, you cannot do that with the traditional primary training curricula that most schools use.
I think that a lot of primary training has been based on the premise that we need to get people drilled in the basics of how to get safely back down to earth before we solo them. How does scenario-based training or moving cross countries to the front of the curriculum, does that delay the point at which students are able to solo because they need some repetition on those basic skills?
Well, they'll get there. They'll get there certainly before we allow them to solo and long before they take their check ride. But if for example, I have no experiences with riding a horse, for example, and I feel this quirky desire of mine, I'm going to go out and see what it's like to ride a horse. So I go to a traditional stables, and they put me in, say, a corral. And I walk around with that horse in the corral, you know, for an hour, and I come back and I walk in the other direction for an hour, and I get home and I'm sore from bouncing around on that horse. Now, that's the traditional way. Now, let's suppose I go to a different riding stable, and instead of going into the corral, we go out on a trail, and we take a trail ride along, a very colorful country, trail along a river. We stop for a picnic. We hitch up and have hamburgers, and then we get back on the trail and we work our way back. Now, I haven't done any of the horse riding exercises that I suppose you would have to do to become a master rider. But with that first experience, I become hooked. I like what I'm experiencing. I like the sensation. I like the freedom of riding a horse down the trail, and I see what I can ultimately do with it. Now, perhaps that's a stretch, but I don't think so. I think if we put a person in an airplane and take them 75 miles down the road to an air museum or to a nice restaurant, or over, in our case, the scenic Niagara Falls, or over Letchworth Park, or over their summer place, or over their house, and just let them fly and enjoy the romance of flying. In fact, for the first 3 or 4 hours, we do nothing as a flight instructor other than helping the student to keep the airplane upright. We want you to climb, descend, turn, soar, pull the power, add power, do what you want. Just fall in love with this thing that we all enjoy doing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you think that people come into this arena already armed with that love of flying. Many of them don't. Many of them get in and they say, oh, no, the instructor kind of slapped my knee, and the instructor made me hold heading. He made me hold altitude. I deviated 100 feet, and they criticized me. I don't need this. I get enough criticism at work.
Yeah.
We don't get into that precision type PTS flying until towards the latter end. And we can trace the evolution of this kind of training. If you go back and look at the old movies of World War II cadet training, where, the War Department had to train 50,000 pilots in a period of 6 months, and they sent them out to flying fields, and they drilled them, and they used this sort of throw them up against the wall and whatever sticks, and the rest drop out. That kind of training has been passed down from generation to generation to generation, so that the individual that comes into the flight school today, he may be a business executive, she may be a lawyer, they may be an individual who's been successful in some other endeavor, and we put him alongside a younger flight instructor, and all of a sudden there's a role reversal, and the instructor is giving them commands and instructions. That person's going to put up with that for about maybe a month, maybe two, and then we never see them again.
Well, that's interesting, Bob, because I think if you can, what you've described is we may be shaking out people who would be very good pilots. I have noticed just in the circle of friends that I've gathered over the few years I've been involved in aviation, that a lot of the naturally good sticks, as they say, the people who have the innate ability to fly an airplane, don't always end up thinking about things deeply enough to become the best decision makers. I've seen people who took longer than normal to get to solo, and maybe longer than normal to get to their check ride, turn out to be good pilots because they had the aeronautical decision making part down better. We don't want to shake these people out.
No, we don't want to shake these people out. We don't want to shake the people out that don't like to fly in the cold weather.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sometimes we just preheat our airplanes and put heaters in the cabins to make it comfortable, just to eliminate the discomfort of operating in adverse conditions. Whatever it takes, our esteemed airport manager here likes to call our service, the whole airport service, a concierge-based type of service, where you walk into the Motel 6 and get your room. You walk into the Ritz-Carlton, and there are people there to greet you with a smile, to carry your bags, to make every step in that hotel a very pleasant experience. And that's what we do here. We try to offer that kind of Ritz-Carlton ambience in very modest facilities, I must say. We have no steel, no glass. We're not like a Signature Aviation at LaGuardia or Teterboro.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have very basic, modest digs here that we operate out of. But everybody's treated here with as if they were the most important person in the world. And while they are here, that's the way we'd like to treat them. Now, that's just on the surface. And then we get them in the airplane, and my goodness, we do everything we can to, again, romanticize that individual with the love of flying and let them, if we can take them above a 3,000-foot overcast sky, up into blue sky above, and let the setting sun reflect on those white puffy clouds from atop, I guarantee you that student will stay with us to the end. They don't want to give up that experience. But if the traditional flight school says, oh, the ceilings are low, we're going to stay in here and do ground school, or maybe we can operate down low and do ground reference maneuvers and never take them up through the clouds. We inherit students from other schools, and we said, well, you know, you had to have 3 hours of instrument training. How did you get that? And, oh, we got that under the hood, you know, or we got that in a flight simulator. Never once were they taken into the clouds and up on top to see a sunrise from the way it's seen from heaven. I mean, that sounds a little bit hokey, but believe me, that works.
All right, works. Bob, when we come back from the break, let's talk about the other two facets of your mission at Bob Miller Flight Training. My guest is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves. Back in a moment. I'm Paul Platt. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
This is a story of two pilots. Our first guy, the one with Garmin Wass GPS, he just arrived home from a trip, ready to enjoy a nice home-cooked meal with his supermodel girlfriend.
Chérie, viens près moi.
But our other guy, the pilot without Wass, well, he couldn't quite make it home. Had to divert to an airport with an ILS approach. So now it's dinner from a vending machine in some crummy pilot's lounge. You know which pilot you want to be. Garmin Wass GPS. Follow the leader.
Chérie.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Welcome back to the Aero News special feature. Paul Plack here with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. We're talking about Bob's just over a year old flight school that started in the Buffalo, New York area in December of 07. And the three things that Bob wanted to accomplish that he thought would be part of his grand experiment. Bob, we've talked about training that produces safer, more proficient pilots and what you thought it would take. Let's talk about reducing the student pilot dropout rate. I note that any salesman that you would talk to who was closing 30 or 40% of the deals that walked in the door would be considered wildly successful. And yet, flight training seems to debate these two positions. Do we go and try to recruit a lot more people where we've already found them, or do we try to make sure that we close more deals once we get people in the door?
Excellent observation. We stumbled upon some numbers that, if you think about, make overwhelmingly good sense. If you look at the national population, we know that less than 0.5% of the U.S. population has a pilot certificate. 0.5%.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here in the Buffalo area, we have about, I would judge, we might have 500 licensed pilots in the Buffalo area.
Mm-hmm.
Out of a general population of 400,000 people. Now, if we extrapolate downward, we take that 0.5% of the U.S. population that holds a pilot certificate, we apply that same 0.5% to our population of 400,000 people, that suggests to us that there ought to be 2,000 pilots in Buffalo and Western New York. There's 500.
Right.
So we conclude there are 1,500 people within a 15-mile radius of our airport that given the proper incentive, given the proper exposure, given the proper opportunity, would naturally become a pilot. We call them the Walter Mitties,
mm-hmm.
the people who have bucket lists that haven't been completely filled yet, the people in midlife who would say, you know, I've always dreamed of being or flying an airplane but never had an opportunity. That becomes our target, and that's right in our own backyard. So what do? I don't say flood the market with advertising. That's too expensive. But we very, very judiciously target print advertising in all of the local newspapers, the local community papers, the professional journals, the Journal of the Bar Association, the Journal of the Local Medical Association, the Business First publication. And we put little quarter-page ads throughout, and that constant exposure is introducing or is reaching those Walter Mitties, as we call them, Walter Mitty, a character out of fiction that, you know, never able to fulfill his dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And these people drift to the airport. And then when they get to the airport, this is a strange phenomenon. It really is. Many times they'll come to our flight school after kind of exploring their competition. And they'll say, well, I went here, I went there, and I went there. And in all three of those other places, said, watch out for Bob Miller flight instruction because they're more expensive. We can do it cheaper. We can put you on an hour per hour basis. We can offer you less expensive flight training.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And so we say, okay. And they come and they ask us, why should we work with you, Bob? You're admittedly, and you say you're more expensive. And what I do, I usually have a G1000 late model 2008 Cessna 172 sitting right outside the window. And I'll say, what I'd like you to do, Mr. Smith or Ms. Jones, I'd like you to go out there and I'd like you to flip on the big red switch on the left and the big white switch right next to it, which turns on the master switch and the avionics master switch. And mm-hmm. they sit there and they watch the primary flight display and the multifunction display go bright, and they begin to see the difference. They walk back in here, and more often than not, they say, Bob, how soon can I start?
Right.
Now, that's the what I would call the Ritz-Carlton approach to marketing. We're not here marketing on the basis that we offer cheap flight or low-cost flight training. The nation's Ivy League colleges and universities are the best in the world, and by far, they're the most expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Without doubt, because I have a daughter right now as a freshman in college, and I know the relative costs of these private colleges and universities. We're patterning after that. I've received phone calls and visits from flight instructors from other schools, and I say, how much do you charge for flight instruction? He says, well, we charge $30 an hour or $35. I says, we charge $65.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I could never charge $65. I said, how much do you charge per hour in your Cessna 172? Oh, 103, 104. I said, we charge 140.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's the difference between your airplanes and ours? Well, ours are new glass cockpit, autopilots, leather seats, terrain avoidance, collision avoidance, weather avoidance, and all of the bells and whistles. And, you know, the kind of people that we want in flight training, the kind of people who are going to go out there and purchase airplanes and purchase supplies.
And fly them when they get done.
And fly them, exactly right. We have our people are renting airplanes. They don't ask, what's the price of gas today? They can afford it. Now, I don't want to sound like we're pandering to the elite upscale population, but frankly, we recognize who has the means to enjoy. Flying is expensive. We make no apology about that. It is expensive, and if you're going to market to the people who can afford to fly, you can't put them out in 1972. You know, tattered airplanes with round gauges that with radios that work half the time and with instructors who are willing to sell themselves short for $15 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we pay our instructors considerably more than the neighboring flight schools pay their instructors. We charge more, but we get better instructors as a result.
Well,
so, I mean, this is classic business 101. It really is.
Well, Bob, we've kind of addressed both issues 2 and 3, and that is reduce the student pilot dropout rate and demonstrate the profitability. Getting back to the dropout rate, though, getting quality people in the door, does that make a difference in the dropout rate?
Yes, it does. Quality people have gone through life's endurances, and they recognize that no good worthwhile endeavor comes easily. That perseverance is the ultimate key to success. You know, we don't want individuals. In fact, I shun individuals. I'll get a young person in here who says, oh, I want to learn how to fly. And they give it a month, and then they want to skip a lesson, and or they're dragging their feet on taking a knowledge test or something like that. In my mind, maybe I'm stereotyping, but this individual doesn't have it in my mm-hmm. mind. And I can beat myself up trying to coax them back in here. And, before they get very far into it, we just have a kind of a heart-to-heart. And, frankly, we almost discourage that kind of a student from coming in here.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if I see a successful business person that comes in that's been successful in other endeavors, architects, engineers, lawyers, doctors, accountants, engineers, these people understand what it takes to be successful. And again, we make no apologies. We also ask our students on day one, what is your end game? What is it that you want to accomplish with your aviation credentials once obtained? You know, if they don't have a clear understanding in their head what they want to do with this, then we really ask the question, are you going to have the perseverance to get through the tough spells, the plateaus? And we square with them right from the get-go. Maybe it's because we have a lower dropout rate because we quite frankly, don't accept everybody into the practice who wants to come in. We almost talk them out of it if it's apparent to us that their goals are not well defined.
Well, Bob, not everybody could do that, obviously, or there would be an awful lot of people who would never get started. But you obviously have found a model there that's working in your situation, and we wish you continued success with it. It's fun to watch what you're doing there.
Well, Paul, it is, and it's very gratifying to us. I think it's gratifying to our instructors, and it's certainly gratifying to the individuals that hang around the office here who have completed their training, and they are our best salespeople. You know, they take they have their certificates. They bought airplanes. They take their friends up. We have students who have purchased airplanes that we take other students up in their brand new airplanes. I mean, this all works hand in hand to build excitement and enthusiasm, which is sorely lacking in much of what we do in the traditional flight training arena.
Well, Bob, we'll watch with interest and see how year two goes, and we look forward to talking to you again next Monday.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
You can read the current edition of Over the Airwaves and find out more about Bob Miller Flight Training Incorporated at www.overtheairwaves.com. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.